anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means, quote, my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge. Isaac Asimov was born on this day, January 2nd, in 1920, 100 years ago. This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is January 2nd, 2020. This is episode 170.
I'm Scott Delonnebaum.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Stuart Prest.
Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks. Pleasure to be here.
On today's show, we're going to be looking ahead with you to the 2020s by doing a bit of a retrospective on the past decade. This is going to be a bit more of a free-form discussion. Our editor's off, so I'm also going to be putting it together fairly loosely. Apologies in advance. Hopefully it's still good. Thanks, though, to those who helped make this show possible. We're up to 79 contributors every month. That's 2 up from our last episode. We didn't hit the 100 I was hoping for by the end of the year. That was overly optimistic. But we are at $249 US per month, which is a pretty solid amount. But I'd love to see that get to 250. That's just one more person. If we hit 300, that'd be even greater. Patreon.com/Politicoast. And help us build the audience by telling more friends about us, share us on Facebook and Twitter, and just generally get the word out. I'm getting messages that people enjoy it, and it'd be great if more people did. And we have a little bit of an announcement. We're now a production of Leg and Boot Media.
Woo! Leg and Boot.
The three of us are the directors of a new nonprofit society that will be representing both this and Canby Report and possible future productions. We don't know yet. We'll be discussing that. We're figuring things out.
Sky's the limit.
But let's jump right in. What's old is new. So our last episode of 2019 was the retrospective on the year. We talked, like we had the last couple years on the podcast, about predictions, things that had happened, the usual. But it feels like everyone's been doing the, what were the 2010s and teens years? And it's our turn to do it. And the thing that's kind of been floating around in my mind is just, how has politics shifted from where we were in 2010 or 2009 even? That was the year I moved to Vancouver, to where we are now. And how did we get here? Are we in a better place? Let's start with that question.
Are we in a better place?
Yeah. Do you think politics has gotten better in any single way?
Well, I think we are moving towards having some more fundamental conversations. I feel like where the 2000s and maybe the early 2010s, we tended to be a little more in the superficial conversations about, you know, tweaking things at the margin a little bit. And our sort of our formal politics still focuses on those discussions. If we think about the federal election we just had, it was this pocketbook, small ball kind of politics. And we didn't have our politicians really engaging in some of these fundamental debates. And yet, right behind that, we clearly are having conversations about the very fundamental nature of our society in a way I don't think we did 10 years ago. So we are talking about things like climate change, climate action, in a really honest, earnest, maybe kind of panicky sort of way, if we look at what's going on in Australia, for instance. And that's not necessarily
panic.
A bad thing. There's an urgency there that was missing from the discussions a decade ago. And likewise,
I would even say up until the last year or two, something really seems to have shifted in kind of the general cultural feel around climate change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very recently.
Yeah, I think different societies go through it at a different time. I feel like in Vancouver specifically, we went through that a couple of years ago when we went through our orange sky summer. And it was mild compared to what we're seeing out of Canberra right now. But those kinds of visceral experiences of a changing climate seems like that has really shifted gears on that conversation.
Well, and I think there are more people involved in politics now than 10 years ago. Idle No More was in the last decade. I think we've seen a resurgence of like a new civil rights era almost, with different, I'm not going to call interest groups, but like people of color speaking up, and the ability of people to come together and demand change. Trans rights are a new thing. Like Canada had same-sex marriage in 2010, but it was a new recent victory then. And now it's well established, but we've, you know, had trans politicians on the scene. Indigenous participation in elections became a real thing. It may be crested, unfortunately, but I think there's still a lot of people on the ground who are doing a lot of great work. And so that's all reasons for optimism.
I think that's actually part of a broader change that we've seen in the last decade, which is the fault lines around politics have shifted in a way they didn't in the 90s or the 2010s or the 2000s.
The decade we still haven't gotten a name for 20 years later.
The aughts.
The aughts.
Yeah. Because no one likes that name.
It feels awkward.
That's the comment I keep seeing is, it's the 20s. Finally, we have like a name for this decade that everyone is happy with and gets. Mm. We won't have to deal with the aughts and tens, teens until, you know, another 80 years.
But that can constrain your thinking too. Like when you talk about the 60s, the 60s is like two different decades and we tend to gloss over that, right? 60s and we talk about, it's usually 65 to 69. And then the first half of the 60s is really just more 50s, right? So
it's like when we talk about generations, it's also a bit muddled.
Yeah, yeah.
Time is arbitrary is what you're saying.
Time is arbitrary.
If anyone's been on Twitter recently, the fight over when the decade technically starts, it really highlights that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, whether it's a one or a zero.
Right. Was there a year zero, and is our calendar actually sufficiently?
It's the most tedious thing on Twitter all week, right, which is really saying something.
I've luckily seen more people taking down the pedants than the actual pedants, but
I think it's pedant.
Yeah. I want to pick up on one thing you said, Scott, is that the fault lines of politics have changed. And at the municipal level, this is something Stuart and I have done actual poli-sci work on, weirdly enough. But at the, you know, provincial, or more so on the federal level, especially in the US and the UK and other countries, we've seen like resurgent nationalisms, populism, and kind of a shift towards, I think, what's largely seen as cosmopolitan versus domestic, rural.
There's an urban rural split going on, and you even seen that in BC. The last provincial election really had that, and if anything, watching the parties since then, that's only intensified. I expect that the Liberals will probably lose one or two of their City of Vancouver seats next election, and that split's probably only going to intensify here, and it's been pretty prevalent federally too, and really prevalent in the U.S. and Britain.
Yeah, you have these different party systems. They express sort of who is, I mean, inside and outside, who is looking to increase inclusivity, who's trying to make space for, you know, for more people, more different ways of being, and those who are looking to try to establish or reestablish or preserve some kind of existing order. It seems like that's one loose way to characterize the debate we see again and again and again, where there's a kind of resistance to change and an encouragement of change, and it pulls in different directions. So you can talk about populism, you can talk of right of center populism, looking to establish brand new ways of being national, let's say, and so on. But you do have this sense in which politics fundamentally is contentious now in a way that it wasn't a decade ago, and that's uncomfortable and terrifying in some ways, depending on which bit of contention we're looking at. But it is also, in a sense, we're at least getting at some issues that have been longstanding that we perhaps didn't pay enough attention to.
Yeah, so I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that economics isn't really as the fault line it was in the last century. You know, it's converged a lot more, where pretty much all the parties more or less support some version of a mixed economy with, you know, market economy for covering a large sector of the economy, and then a social safety net and robust government services. And the exact midst of that gets tweaked a bit, but there's no longer really a push for, you know, socialism or any of that stuff in the way there was before. It's not quite as prevalent as the defining fault line.
I think that's where we kind of got to in the previous 20 years. And now I think the frustrations inherent in
there's
that,
a bit of a resurgence in that, like, you know, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and whatnot. But at the same time, it's still much more within a narrow range than it would have been 40, 50 years ago.
In that people aren't advocating for actual communism, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Even communist countries are not really communist anymore.
Yeah. So as that fault line narrowed, it wouldn't surprise me if politics found a new fault line.
Yeah,
I think, on there when that became less contentious.
Yeah, I think that's there's something there. I think part of it, too, is that when economics does filter into the conversation, it is filtered through different kinds of debates in some ways than we've seen before. So the part of what we're seeing right now is a response to globalization, this massive process that's happening all over the world. And some people see a move to greater inclusivity and exchange as a way forward for them. So they're broadly supportive of that sort of large project you're just describing. And in Canada, given how much Canada remains a trading country, it seems like there's a pretty broad consensus in Canada, more so than in other parts of the world, that Canada has to be engaged in the world. BC has to be engaged in the world. Vancouver has to be engaged in the world for us all to prosper. In other parts of the world, that is much more up to debate. We see much more resistance and people who are just feeling utterly left behind by that entire process. When we look at who's in and who's out on Brexit, those who were not really deeply integrated into the European project were pretty skeptical. Like, that the integration has been uneven. When we look at who is most likely to support Donald Trump, it's people that are not on the coastal edges, that are most deeply integrated in the rest of the world. So where that integration has worked out well for people, or at least there is a promise it could work out well in the future, people are willing to go along with it. But where that integration hasn't happened as much, there's this deep skepticism, and it can express itself as a fundamental rejection of some of these big projects that we were okay with a decade or two ago.
Yeah, well, 20 years ago was the Battle of Seattle. It was, you know, the giant protests against the WTO in Seattle, where all the leftists and the unions got out and literally made it a riot, and a bunch of great punk songs were written about it, and that's what I grew up on listening to. But then 9/11 happens, and I think very quickly global trade becomes the norm, and it's the default, and it's that consensus you're just talking about, Scott. And I think what happens over the last little bit is, as inequalities grow and people do get left behind, as Stuart's talking about, that resentment grows. And that's where we kind of got to this situation where people are looking for outlets, whether that's Brexit or Trump or some other different change. So I think we're still on the cusp
or socialism.
Or socialism.
Like,
yeah,
an idea that
Corbyn or Sanders.
Right, that this economy is not functioning for a certain segment of the population. So it's not necessarily an accident that Corbyn's support skews pretty young. Those are the people who are feeling relatively underserved by this current economic project.
I think I saw a poll recently that, like, a Ben Shapiro type was trying to post derisively, saying like a third of U.S. millennials and Gen Z support or communism, like full capital C communism. And he's like, oh no. And it is, I think, born of a frustration and possibly also like a lack of direct connection with the Cold War era, where it was just constant propaganda and discussion about, you know, the Russian threat. And
yeah,
I would not have wanted to have lived in the Soviet Union, to be clear, but it was just like, not having grown up in that era, I think people see it differently now.
Wow. Yeah, so that was actually, yeah, that whole thing blew up the day I took end of my Twitter break. So I don't watch that, which was super fun. And yeah, that was really interesting because it was basically a Rorschach test and what everybody means by the word socialism, communism, and capitalism for that matter, so much. It's pretty much everyone was just talking past each other on that one.
Right.
And that's not new. I think some of the founders of the Soviet Union deliberately like mixed whether they called it communist or socialist, depending on what they thought would sell better.
And also, like, there's a lot of modern misunderstanding around that. You know, your Bernie Sanders types point to the Nordic countries quite a bit, even though there is no way they could be called communist. And, you know, they have pretty robust market economies. They generally rate among the highest, like, freedom of business in the world and whatnot. So,
and they also have safety nets, of course.
Yeah. Actually, if you want to have fun and stir something up, ask Rose Twitter how neoliberal they are and watch them go off on that.
Well, even like Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, but you compare his policies and he's kind of a centrist Canadian politician, maybe a standard New Democrat, but, like, you know, he's just outside the Overton window in the U.S., so.
We have incredibly popular social democratic programs in Canada when we talk about things like universal health care. When you collect money and you pay for everything in, you know, through a single payer system and guarantee everyone the same level of access to the system, it's not communism in some sort of scary 1917 sort of way. It's just that's social democracy, and it's okay. There are aspects of that in most states, even in the U.S. The U.S. has programs like Medicare and Medicaid where everybody pitches in and pays for health care for certain segments of the population. It's just the universality of that is not accepted in the U.S. in a way that it is accepted in most other states.
Well, let's bring it a little more tangibly. Let's start with British Columbia. 10 years ago...
Before we do that...
Go ahead.
So before we jump onto that, so one of, I think, the other big macro trends that's affected politics worldwide has to be social media. That's the thing that, in addition to some of the change in fault lines we talked about already, is social media, I think, has really defined the last decade in terms of politics.
For better or worse?
Mostly worse, but there's been some good stuff coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to think back 10 years ago, there was considerable promise to Twitter, this idea that you could move past the filters and the gatekeepers and have real conversations with one another and with politicians, and they could actually respond in real time to their followers or citizens, that you'd say those things and you'd say in a positive way, like, this is going to be really great. And we've now seen the perils of a lack of filter, particularly when there's so much influence to be won through social media. And that's become clear that this can be a thing that can be turned into, I don't want to use the weaponized gets overused, but this idea that you can use social media to further concrete political ends, and you don't necessarily need to do so in an earnest, good faith sort of way. You can try to find ways to manipulate, to appeal emotionally, to misrepresent. And there's all these negative aspects of social media engagement that we're seeing now, and we still don't have a full set of implementable solutions to counteract all that.
Yeah, I'm partway through Joseph Heath's slightly older book, like a couple years old, called Enlightenment 2.0, which is very similar, actually, to David Moskrop's Too Dumb for Democracy that we've discussed quite frequently on this show, including with David a couple times. And both make the argument that, a bit from our biology and psychology, that our brains really aren't built for rational thought, and they're very easily exploited by the environment to do thinking badly. You know, unless you're in a very nice, controlled situation where you can sit, slow down, and let your deeper, slower processes have the time to deal with information, you're generally going to make gut instinct decisions that are sometimes good, but more often are not very rational or thought through. And it's really depressing starting that book when it was like the Enlightenment 2.0, which was written shortly after, I think, the Romney 2012 election or Romney Obama 2012 election. And it was like, you know, this was bad. And I was like, oh, you naive fool. Mm-hmm. And just seeing how much worse and how much faster news and processing and politics got after that, and in the latter half of this last decade especially, where suddenly it's just news headline after headline scrolling your Facebook or Twitter or
it wasn't particularly healthy in the aughts with 24-hour cable news and everything, but it's got a lot worse.
And so I think that's challenge of how do we slow news down, how do we slow politics down, is still out there. I'm biased. I think podcasts help because talking these things through is a way to activate some of our more rational thought processes. And I think
it's useful. And I think we also have a good release schedule because, you know, for the most part, unless you're actively involved in like politics professionally, the go, always getting new information on Twitter actually isn't all that helpful for a lot of the reasons you said. Like, for the average person, probably the ideal window to get your news is somewhere between once a day and once a week.
And the thing we saw in the last year particularly was attention start to turn to this, and the role that these social media giants, the Facebook, Google, Twitter, Apple, have in controlling how we understand the world deserves better scrutiny, because these companies have become more powerful than small countries. The latest Doctor Who involves a character who leads a company.
It's spoilers.
I'm not spoiling the episode. It's just a premise from it. Who leads a company, and he's described as having more power than many small countries. And they're like, that can't be true. And it's like, no, actually.
Yep.
And here we got to this point without, I think, a lot of critical retrospection or thought. And now how do we disentangle this is going to be a challenge. Mm-hmm. But at least we're aware of it.
Well, we've had cautionary voices like Joseph Heath, the Dave Moskrops of the world. There've been a number of researchers looking at this problem for a while, UBC actually, and U of T and elsewhere in Canada. But we haven't had strong action. And part of this problem, and I guess this is the episode where I talk about globalization a lot, but there's an ongoing struggle where we have the state. The state can regulate our lives. It's really good at that. But the forces that seem to be shaping the world now are much more often transnational, which requires states to ultimately cooperate to really effectively regulate. Otherwise, it's just each state regulating a little piece. So Germany can try to drive a hard bargain with Facebook, and they're better at it than other states. They're willing to stand up to social media in ways that other countries seem not to be.
Or the EU more broadly.
But in Canada, it seems like the government is, federal government is relatively unwilling to take a hard stand against social media companies, and these social media companies are big. They offer all kinds of resources, and so it's not an easy thing to do, even for a government of a state the size of Canada's. And that's a problem we see again and again, where the forces are transnational, the regulation is national, and in this increasingly confrontational realist world we seem to be living in right now, cooperation is actually harder than it was 10 years ago, even as the problems become much more acute.
Man, imagine if the United Nations was something anyone cared about or could affect any real global policy.
Yeah, I mean, the UN is...
It has its value.
It has its value. It is the states, the collective will of states, and it is ultimately the most important decisions happen at the Security Council. And there you have the P5 that have a veto, and it limits actions to those areas where most states agree and all the most important states, well, except France. Sorry, France, agree on what should happen. And when you're looking for agreement or near consensus before action is taken, then you're always going to move to a lowest common denominator action.
All right. Well, let's turn a little more tangibly to here in British Columbia. A decade ago, Gordon Campbell was premier. I'm tired. I have a baby. She holds her head up now. It's adorable.
Aww.
Gordon Campbell's premier. A couple years later, HST debacle. Christy Clark's premier. More recently, we switch over and suddenly the NDP are in after tying in the election. You know, Liberals win with an asterisk. And it's interesting because none of these premiers are, I think, reasonably categorized as populist in the way we usually think of. I think Gordon Campbell's the closest, but a lot of the wave he came in on was just the NDP needs to go. They've bungled things for too long. They got too long in the tooth in government. I think I just saw a picture of where the fast ferries are sitting, and I just reread the whole story.
They're like in Egypt or Greece, somewhere in the
middle. They're in a dock outside Egypt. Rotting because they're not good for anything. They were so bad. And so Gordon Campbell comes in with enthusiasm about a new way, opening BC up to business. It kind of just rides through his era, effectively, as far as I can tell, governing by whatever book he'd read that week. And he read a lot of smart books.
Yeah, there's sort of anger, frustration with the previous government, but the way in which he went about governing, there was this almost technocratic aspect to it, which is the antithesis of populism. He's trying to say, like, this is a good idea, so we should do that. So that's how you end up with a Liberal government, which is very resource friendly in BC, and yet embracing a carbon tax. It's like, well, this is a good policy idea, so we're going to do it. Running a reasonably good faith citizens assembly on proportional representation with a very high threshold. So in hindsight, the threshold made it almost impossible to adopt a change to a proportional representation system. But they really went, they invested in a citizens' assembly. That was a real thing that happened.
I mean, notably, the 1996 election, the BC Liberals clearly won the popular vote, but had the NDP win a majority government. So I think they had a reason to want a different system.
They were
then.
To a point, although governments do have short memories, and generally you are in favor of a proportional representation as a government up until you win power, and you think, well, I can always win power again after that. So for them to even stick it out that long, I thought I'll give them part marks for that.
That's worth noting. BC has had its share of populace in the past, the most notable being Bill van der Zandt in the late 80s, who...
Still kicking around every now and then.
And the 2010s, he's not, like, he's not there anymore.
Well, I mean, as premier, he kind of soared and crashed. He flew a little too close to the sun on his... We just need to set that aside and do a full episode on Bill van der Zandt one day. It's a fascinating tale of madness from a different era.
If you ever get Keith Baldry in here, you can get him to talk about
it. Yeah, I read his book. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. Crazy stuff.
So how else do we see the past decade of British Columbia being, like, I always see BC as being almost a unique little island in the politics of the world that's just, like, slightly different, and things seem to work weird and different here, and kind of
BC's
like
always had a reputation for having odd politics.
Well, and it's almost like naive to the rest of the world. It's like everyone's still squabbling about climate change. We're like, well, our right wingers will bring in a carbon tax, and our left wingers will say, no, we will get rid of that tax, and maybe we'll do something else. It was a weird decade.
I mean, it has its oddness, but I think you can make a case that BC has become a little more conventional over the last decade. So I can point to a couple of things, particularly the last couple of years, where you have this, well, for one thing, you got rid of some of the money in politics. I think that was important. One of the ways politics can remain wild is when you have unlimited access to funds at municipal and provincial levels. And so to the extent that money is being limited now, it does turn politics into a little more of a conventional process. And it does open up new conversations. And you can have a lower threshold to entry to some different voices. So that, I think that's positive, and also sort of a move away from BC being different to the Wild West of politics. So there's that. There is also that the divides that we see in Canada today, I make the argument, they're more or less reproduced. I don't know if the ratio is exactly the same, but it's quite close, where you have interior BC, heavily resource dependent, and somewhat skeptical about things like a carbon tax, and perhaps less enthusiastic about a broader what you could call a cosmopolitan agenda. And then you have the coastal BC, which is much more urbane, cosmopolitan, and its values. It strongly endorses some idea of action on climate, and that seems to go pretty far across the spectrum. So you have folks and kids voting for Green Party candidates or things like that, right? So you have a pretty wide buy-in in the cities, and acceptance that this is something that is at or near top of mind and justifying real action. And if you look at Canada writ large, that is more or less what the country looks like today. So in some ways, BC has become the miniature Canada in a way that we often think of sort of Ontario being, say, some of the same major debates that drive politics. I don't think BC drives the country in the same way, but I think it reflects the country in a way we don't see in many other provinces right now.
The way I know BC doesn't drive the country, and then I'll go to you, Scott, is watching the New Year's Eve countdown. I switched to CBC Vancouver to try to watch the countdown at midnight, and Rick Mercer's hosting, and they're like, all right, it's 5 to midnight on my clock. And he's like, all right, we'll go over to Brian Adams in Toronto and listen to his song. And so he's playing, and we're just listening to it, and my wife looks at her watch, and it's suddenly midnight, and we're like, where was the countdown? and after his song was done, they're like, all right, up to Whitehorse, where it's now just past midnight. And they're just like in the middle of fireworks. And I was like, what are we, chopped liver out here? And sometimes we
mark the occasion well. Yeah.
So I won't be
watching
CBC.
This is what breeds us Western alienation.
Yeah, it really does.
Rick Mercer's hosting.
I don't think it was even his fault.
No, it's not his fault.
That was a nice detour to totally throw you off.
Yeah, but circling back, I think part of that might have to do with a broader trend we're seeing where all politics gets nationalized in a way. Like there's less, or the themes that happen in provincial and local politics mirror those at the federal level more. Now you see that in the states a lot too, where, state level elections are a lot more predicted by how national parties are doing than they used to be. And kind of seems like the same thing's happening in Canada, maybe a little slower.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. The U.S. has a strong driver of the parties being the same parties at every level, and actually the same branches of the same umbrella.
Yeah, but the conversations seem to trickle down from the national level more than they used to, and inflect the local conversations more.
Right. Well, I think in like the city of Vancouver and Victoria in particular, you're seeing a lot of what could be called an activist city council that's willing to make symbolic motions on issues of provincial and federal jurisdiction, and BC's fight around Trans Mountain is arguably stepping on federal toes, and healthcare has always been a weird one that gets overlapped.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen some of that in the past too. I mean, Vancouver is a nuclear-free zone, and that's wading very clearly and defiantly into federal jurisdiction. So
they haven't stopped that either. There's a motion this year about the nuclear-free zone.
It's just renewing it and updating it slightly.
Yeah. So there's when politicians at a municipal level feel like they need to take a stand on national politics, they'll do so. And when they feel like they'd rather not, then they will say, that's what was the phrase Lisa Helps used about China? It's above my pay grade, which I don't think is a great way to phrase something. That's
especially in the year when Victoria Council considered tripling their own salary, which wasn't unjustifiable, but it was like...
It's a pretty low salary.
Maybe then she'd talk about China.
Yeah, maybe.
So. And Brad West would be very happy. One of the trends, though, that's very evident in BC that we've yet to see really hit the electoral system is the population of BC is really starting to urbanize. More and more people are moving to Metro Van and fewer are living in rural BC. And at some point, the redistricting is going to have to come around and go, Metro Van actually needs a lot more representation. Maybe the North needs less. And that's going to be a fight that it's going to be really interesting to watch, because the NDP will benefit from that in the short term and the Liberals will suffer from it. And therefore it'll be a very partisan fight of, you don't care about representing Northern rural British Columbians.
Well, yeah. I mean, you say in the short term, and that, I mean, that's a good caveat, because part of what's in the background here is not just populism, but polarization, right? The polarization of BC politics mirrors what we've seen nationally, but it doesn't necessarily need to stay that way forever. The Liberals have had a history of success in urban areas as well. And so they can find messages that can appeal across that rural urban divide. But
it'd be nice if they started trying to find those.
I think that was what the promise of Andrew Wilkinson was, like, here's our urban, educated, elite BC Liberal leader. And instead he just comes off as elite, out of touch, uncharming.
And spends a lot of time playing to the rural base.
Ineffectively. Well, I mean, they're probably happy.
I mean, they're going to vote for him, so like, kind of effectively.
Right.
Like, he's not likely to lose seats outside of the cities.
No, but again, that's can be an indication of a polarized electorate. We're looking for different priorities. The parties are sort of assumed to stand for one thing or another, and so I think that can happen in the short term. Part of what's going to happen with that question of redistricting is essentially the way in which we think about the specific districts can change as well. So I was doing a few interviews during the last federal election with folks in Coquitlam, Port Coquitlam, places like that. And those are real battlegrounds, are like where the town meets the city, right? Mm-hmm. And the values are in tension. And those are areas where federal Liberals, in this case, were quite competitive. And so that the city can expand, and we can see that, just as Scott, you were saying earlier about this idea of federal and provincial politics mimicking one another. When we have this polarization, the party system through which the polarization gets expressed is different, but we can see some commonalities there.
I think it was the Port Moody or Port Coquitlam riding that on the federal election took one of the longest to finally declare and considered a recount. And it was a three-way race between the NDP Conservatives and Liberals, with I think the Conservatives winning in the end, just barely.
Yeah, but if you do that, the math, some people seem to endorse that. Well, two out of three voters are voting for a party that is center-left, is embracing some kind of action on climate change, then you have that. But
I like the Conservatives.
You can divide those a lot of ways.
I like the Conservatives who talk about two out of three voters supporting cuts to income taxes.
Right, right. There's a lot of different ways you can play that sort of math.
So it will still be an interesting decade for BC politics. And I don't just say that because I want to keep the show going for another decade. But like the 2017 election, I think it's easy to forget how close it was based on how stable it's been. Like, it was basically a tie with the Greens holding the balance of power. And if our party system hadn't gotten so absurdly strong that no one ever breaks ranks, this government could be at risk every day, or at least twice a year when there actually are confidence votes. And its agenda could be a lot harder to push through. But here we are, 2 years in, a bit over, and it looks clear that the NDP will govern until the 2021 election.
Or at least until they choose not to. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they are comfortably in control of the situation right now.
But it doesn't actually take a lot for the Liberals to get back in the game.
No, not at all.
They have the money.
They had a couple bad quarters of fundraising, but I think they're on their way to fixing that. But the, I think that's also part of what's led to Andrew Wilkinson not seeming all that effective. He's been really focused on just winning a couple, like, suburban edge of the metro area ridings back.
When the town meets the city and
just needs to pick up a couple of those and the Liberals are back in power if they can hold everything else.
Yep. And they can make appeals that the economy in certain parts of the province is suffering. So if timber doesn't bounce back, say, then that can be something they can build on and maybe even pick off a few votes elsewhere. That if they can make the case stick that the NDP has not really been a great steward of the economy.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the challenge with that, though, is, like I said, they risk losing some of their seats that they barely held last time. Pretty sure Sam Sullivan's going to have a really tough battle next election because, if anything, the city of Vancouver's moving away from supporting the Liberals just based on how they've been campaigning and targeting their messaging.
Yeah, I think there is still a business type class, a professional class, lawyers, doctors, the 1% essentially, who would be sympathetic to the Liberals, but that's hard to win a full riding, even in downtown Vancouver, False Creek, where Sam Sullivan is based. I think the other thing we need to talk about for the past decade of BC politics is the Greens and their rise from kind of fringe party to first elected MLA to, holding the balance of power and now on the cusp of the unknown as they have to choose a new leader. And it looks like that leader will probably come from outside caucus. Unless Sonia Fursten outruns, because I think Adam Olson is...
Well, he's the interim leader, he's not running now.
Well, they've had success. They've managed even to settle into a bit of a regional presence, right? That, and in a first-past-the-post system, you need to have votes that are geographically concentrated if you're going to pick off some seats. And so they've managed to do that, but they're still fairly limited, it seems like, in the number of districts that they can actually capture that... plurality of votes. And so given the current constellation of politics in BC, they still seem, significantly capped. And that, of course, is in the background a huge part of what is giving the present situation its stability. The Greens know that they have not so much a hand on the wheel as like a finger on the wheel. They are at the margins able to influence this NDP government. And as marginal as that influence is, it's much more likely than not to be better than whatever would come out of another election. It was a bit of a freak occurrence for them to capture the exact balance of power between these two parties. And the province remains polarized. So you can imagine an outcome that's still in the ballpark, but to actually land on a situation where they hold the balance of power seems relatively unlikely. And so with the failure of the third proportional representation referendum, they can't really look to that as an option for growth, to have voters be able to express their views in a different way. So now they have to think about, well, what are they going to do? Just try to solidify that vote? Are they going to look to cooperate with whoever governs, or are they just going to sit on the margins again?
It's going to be tough because they're very likely to hold the two seats that aren't Andrew Weaver's, I think. Those ones are fairly secure. But without Andrew Weaver in Oak Bay, there's a decent chance it reverts back to one of the previous parties that held
it. It'll be a fight. Yeah.
And there isn't a clear fourth riding for them to really go after that's a likely win for them.
And ideologically, the question is now open for the BC Greens, and we'll talk about the federal Greens in a bit, of, do they continue the path Andrew Weaver kind of set out, which is the intellectual, almost policy wonky centrist approach, and try to peel votes from both parties going down the middle, or, and possibly even more from the BC Liberals, or do they adopt the eco-socialist approach that's kind of gaining infamy or fame, if not actual traction, to try to take the disaffected NDP core from Metro Van and Vancouver Island, who are like, why are you going to LNG? Why are you canceling or doing sightseeing that way? And
I don't think you're going to be able to out NDP the NDP on a lot of those things. So, yeah, they can double down on the environmental stuff and peel off NDP voters who are disappointed on stuff like Site C and LNG. But the more the socialist half of the eco-socialist thing, I don't see a viable path for the Greens to take on that. So, yeah, they're probably better off sticking with the environmental stuff and really doubling down on that, especially as climate issues become more salient.
Although as climate issues become more salient, they are being more spoken to by the mainstream parties, which has always been the issue with single issue parties, is once your issue is usurped by a big tent, your raison d'etre is gone.
Well, and interesting. Yeah, you're sorry to cut you off there, but the interesting thing about, what do we talk about, do the Greens want to shift far to the left? If you think about, well, which voters who may be inclined to vote Green or vote for a Green supportive party are most badly underserved in Canada right now, and I think that extends to BC politics. It's right of center voters. They're the less likely to find a party that conveys their interests. So while there's the broad movement that Green politics tends to be socially, fiscally left of center, you can make a case that the best place for them to go fishing for votes is on the right of center, where you're saying I'm fiscally responsible. Maybe I own my own house. Maybe I vote for the Green councillors in Vancouver, for instance. And I don't know if I trust the Liberals to continue this project that Gordon Campbell started a decade ago. I don't feel like the party is as behind it as it once was. And certainly if we look at where people might vote federally, it's a different story. But there isn't that place to park your vote if you want to express that. And so you could make the case that the Green Party actually would be better served tilting to the right and trying to pick up those disaffected voters.
Green voters in general, on average, tend to be whiter than average, wealthier than average. And like several of those demographics also describe a lot of people who vote BC Liberal. And so there's, I think, room to grow there for them if they follow what you're laying out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that would ever happen, but there's certainly a case there to be done.
Well, let's pivot to close out the show on federal politics. A decade ago, Stephen Harper had a minority government and would soon pick up a majority with the NDP becoming the official opposition, and the Liberals looked like they were going to be wiped out. By the end of the decade, the NDP is on the opposite end of that poll, despite the kind of last-minute surge during the election that saved the deck chairs before the Titanic sunk of the party. And the Liberals are back in a majority government, or a minority government now, having just been slightly reduced, but are still in a much stronger place than they were just 5-7 years ago. The Conservatives, meanwhile, ditched Stephen Harper, but he's clearly still pulling a lot of strings, especially as Andrew Scheer, Harper with a smile, has taken the long sunset. I guess, though, he still wants to be an elected MP for a while, so he'll still be around. I don't know where we want to start. Maybe the Conservatives are the most interesting. Is Harperism dead?
Good question. Well, I don't think the Conservatives really have a great idea of what they want to be. They kind of punted on the issue in the last leadership race, and I'm not confident they'll necessarily not do the same thing again this time, but the party needs to have a solid conversation about what it actually means to be a conservative in the 2020s.
Yeah. They have three different debates and they're having them all at the same time, but it's not clear they're going to have any of them sufficiently thoroughly. So of all the parties to watch federally, the Conservatives are far and away the most interesting to watch right now. It seems like, fair to say, there's a bit of a struggle for control behind the scenes. So when you see a couple of folks like Jenny Byrne, according to Nike, so clearly coming out against the against Mr. Scheer, that suggests that the sort of a coordinated action there to try to retake power. And when you have Stephen Harper involved in this conservative fund, so it seems like there's a real attempt to try to redirect the party into something that is more likely to win. So there's like an attempt to try to control things a little more, and I think that's playing out as we watch, and that's part of what's slowing the process of actually convening the process of selecting a leader. So I guess it's happening in November now,
but that they shifted the policy convention to November,
but
they haven't set a date yet.
Oh, they still haven't set that date.
No, they just announced the committee that'll be deciding.
Oh,
all
that's
of
right,
these.
That's right. So they said so the committee is going to decide it. Right.
Yes,
you're right. And so that's all playing out, and things are getting cans are getting kicked down the road to allow that process to play out. Then they have this debate: do they want to pick somebody who's electable? Right? Do they want to out Trudeau with somebody who can sparkle and can draw attention in a way that Andrew Scheer could not in any kind of sustained way? But then you have these fundamental policy debates. Are they socially inclusive? Is it a party where LGBTQ issues are more or less taken as read, or are they going to be up for debate? What about abortion? So those issues are all getting debated. Is it going to be this party that is an expression of regional alienation? Is it the voice of the West? Is this Reform Plus, Reform 2.0? It kind of seems like it is right now. And that's not clear at all that that can win at a certain point. I don't think Ontarians really are going to vote to try to prop up the Alberta economy. That doesn't seem
It seems like a dead end politically.
Right.
But
they can clean up. They can win 80% of the vote in Alberta and Saskatchewan and still lose the election with a strategy like that. But the strongest voices in the party right now are folks like Jason Kenney. So it's still pulling that party in that direction. So they're having...
And not just Jason Kenney. Like a lot of the rank and file conservatives are, well, pretty polarized. And
yeah. I mean, when we talk...
I'm not necessarily sure a lot of them are really going to be doing the math on what the electoral strategy should be.
Well,
and the leadership race gets underway.
They may think that if you can put together the strong economy first argument, which has a prominent place for action on oil and gas, plus a more inclusive social message, say, that might be enough to put them over the top, because they're looking at the last election and saying, well, we'll be lost. But we're close. Like, we're not that far off. And the Liberals, 2, 3, or 4 years from now, whenever the election comes, are going to have 2, 3, 4 more years of baggage, right? So there's a reasonable chance they could just pick off the next election anyways and then go ahead with their preferred agenda rather than abandoning what they see as currently a core message. For those who see, who are skeptical about climate still, skeptical of climate action, to embrace that just to try to curry favor with cosmopolitan voters, they may see that as a betrayal of principle.
It was fascinating being back in Alberta for 10 days over the holidays and just kind of either talking to in-laws or extended family or watching the nightly news, which is just a weird window because Alberta's hegemony is, you know, we must kowtow to oil and gas in everything. The nightly news, one of the lead stories one night on Global News was, here are all the new taxes and fees you as a resident of Calgary will pay based on what the city, the provincial and federal government is. And, you know, they come to the federal carbon tax. Well, they're like, well, the Alberta had gotten rid of its carbon tax, so now we're going to be stuck with the federal one. So you'll be paying probably this much a year. By the way, you'll probably get some money back from the government, but more taxes from Calgary. And they just kind of like, it wasn't a lie. They didn't lie about the policy, but they downplayed the reality that the federal carbon backstop does pay most people all the money back.
It'll be interesting to see when people get that tax return and they actually see the numbers for themselves. I'm curious if that shifts the conversation at all. This last election, even though it's a minority, allows that carbon tax to play out a little bit more. People can see how it works. Mm-hmm. And as we saw in the U.S. with Obamacare, it was hugely unpopular with a lot of Republicans until they started to see it in action. They're like, hey, actually, I kind of like this healthcare thing. Maybe we should not get rid of it. And the debate is still playing out. But the program became more popular when people saw what it actually did. And when you see something that gives you a hefty rebate at the end of the year or whenever you file your taxes, then that may become less unpopular fairly quickly.
And I think one of the challenges for the Conservative Party is what Scott essentially brought up is the Conservative members themselves is, in Canada, the party members choose the leader. And so it almost incentivizes becoming more and more insular until you finally, as a member, realize, oh, we want to win eventually. But I don't know that conservative members have raised that. Exactly.
No. And this is where we get to be a little wonky. The way in which the conservatives pick their leader will help save them from that, right? Where they have this points-based system where each riding gets to elect 100 points worth of leader, I think is kind of how it works.
Yes,
yeah. It's 100 points per riding.
Right. And so that ensures that whoever wins is going to have some measure of support from across the country. So you can't just have this dominant voice from Alberta, Saskatchewan. You've got to appeal more broadly. There's going to be conservatives, you know, they have no hope of winning in the places they're coming from. They're still going to have a role in picking the leader.
Yeah, the two conservatives in Vancouver Centre have a lot of power.
They actually have a pretty active EDA.
Okay, I was trying to think of one. One of the other challenges, though, I did see some polling out of Frank Graves from ECOS this past year where he's looking at the conservatives closely and how different parties are centered. And the conservatives, we talked earlier about the open and closed-minded approach to society. And the conservatives have, like, cornered the market on those who want a closed society, who don't want open borders, who want a more nationalistic approach, who want that strong-minded leader. Sort of Stephen Harper, but even more tough. What was actually interesting in the latter half of this decade was the few times Stephen Harper popped his head up and would do an interview, he would sometimes repudiate indirectly his own legacy. You know, I remember one interview I think he did where he was like, you know, we should be a bit more skeptical about free trade these days, because this was post-Trump when Trump was rallying about NAFTA. And I was like, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was kind of endorsing the big populist messages.
I think he signed more free trade deals than all the other prime ministers stuck together, or something close to it.
Well, yeah, and that was a part of a bipartisan growing consensus. After 1988, Canada has this election fought on free trade with the U.S. And since then, there's been pretty much within a couple of years, so the Liberals sign on to NAFTA, right? You've had bipartisan support for all free trade. And even the NDP, it divides somewhere in the middle where you have a certain amount of skepticism of free trade given on sort of the idea of a fair trade, actually. The same kind of rhetoric put to different use that we hear from Donald Trump, but the idea that you want to make sure that the trade deals are put together in a fair sort of way, so you are a little more skeptical. But so 2.5 of Canada's three national parties, on that score anyways, are embracing trade. So we're having this latter-day turn. It's fairly recent. It's this idea of populism becoming a little stronger, where you have increasing skepticism from someone like Stephen Harper. It's a break from what had been a pretty strong consensus.
But even that, like, that's kind of notable for how rare it is even now in the Conservative Party to have trade skeptical people say anything about that.
And I think that's trying to keep in the sort of potential PPC voter. It seems like the main dominant view of conservatives is that immigration broadly is a good thing. We just got to manage it better, and we got to probably be more skeptical about, say, refugee claims or something like that, or returnees from conflict zones, so formerly associated with ISIS, that sort of thing. So ways to express toughness. But you have in Canada a pretty strong consensus, I think, and the utter failure of the PPC to get traction anywhere suggests that most Canadians are not super receptive to let's cut down on immigration in a wholesale way kind of message.
All right. Well, I'm keeping an eye on the clock. We have a few more minutes left, though. Are there other federal parties or federal issues we want to touch on? You know, the Green Party's looking at a leadership race. The Liberals are in a tough situation, a minority. The NDP is in a very weird place. The Bloc Québécois exists.
Still,
but I don't think any of us have strong opinions on or understandings of Quebec politics.
Well, Quebec is this funny thing where it seems like they're, as an entire electorate, they're willing to just roll the dice on a new party every election or two. And so they were tired of the Bloc. Not necessarily. There's a hard limit on how far the Liberals can grow in the province. So they're like, let's try out this NDP thing. And they tried it out and like, no, I don't like it. And inroads that Jack Layton was able to make, Jagmeet Singh was really not able to continue on. So Mulcair was able to sort of hold the fort a bit. And now we're back to what the NDP kind of looked like maybe in the 1990s, really.
One more seat than that.
One more seat.
And I think it's got a higher percentage of vote. I think they're at 5 to 10 as opposed to like 1 to 2.
So they're not totally gone, but they're sort of the idea of a party that is limited to urban cores is a place where they can make an appeal. Urban cores of English speaking Canada. That's a pretty sharply limited box. Just as if the Conservatives can't break in outside of the rural ridings, if they can't win any of the 60 most populous ridings or densely populated ridings, I should say. If the NDEP is unable to break out going the other direction, then we have this strangely balkanized country. But it's not even necessarily province by province. It's urban core versus hinterland. And so that's the divide that is polarized that we do need to really try to think about how to address if we were trying to fix the country as opposed to just talk about it on a podcast.
I don't have much to add on the party, but I do think it would be interesting kind of look ahead over the next 10 years and kind of see what are the big things we'll be talking about over the next decade. And I think climate has to be up there for sure. And the other one I'd say is probably China, how Canada and the West in general is going to interact with the rise in China is probably going to be a fairly large part of the next decade's politics.
Yeah. We've been saying that for years, and now it's here. So we got to talk about it.
It's arrived.
Based on today's news, which may be totally out of date by the time you listen to this, it might be Iran that we're talking about for the next couple of years, and war and worse things. So
even that's going to be more limited to a region than China will be.
Well, and it's also symptomatic of, here I'll do an IR, international relations riff. The U.S. has just been utterly unable to make this pivot towards Asia-Pacific issues in a sustained
sort of
way.
Yeah, I remember 2008, that was going to be Barack Obama's big thing.
Yeah, pivot towards Asia. When they've been talking about it off and on since the 1990s. The 1990s was all about trying to incorporate China into the global economy, and that was sort of done through bringing them into the World Trade Organization. And then since then, the U.S. has just been distracted by war after war in the Middle East, and it is unable to quit the Middle East, even though it is, aside from oil, which the U.S. is more or less increasingly independent of anyways because of fracking and all that, they're just unable to move away from a focus on the Middle East to pay attention to this, what has become a strategic rivalry, which they may not win. They're not on the upper trajectory, really.
Yeah, although China has some pretty big problems looming, too.
Oh, China may not win anyway.
Yeah, there's some...
Nobody may win this
major one. Demographic things they're going to have a lot of trouble with.
Oh, absolutely.
Climate, China, anything else we're looking forward to in the next year? Final thoughts.
Well, that was the next decade, really.
Next decade.
Trying to figure out this idea of inclusivity. That's going to continue on, too. So including people in economic progress, this global economy that doesn't really fit everyone, doesn't have a place for everyone.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning, though, that globalization has done wonders for huge swaths of humanity that's basically been lifted out of poverty.
No, we have this part of this paradoxical thing where globalization is, when we talk about the rise of China also brought hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Like that's a real thing that we should acknowledge. But at the same time, the idea of stable economic prospects for people in places like Canada and the US and the UK, all over the world, that is more uneven now than it was a generation ago. And I think looking back and looking forward, there's going to be that tension there where it seems like some people, life is going to be comfortable, and for others, life is going to be uncomfortable. And we have this sort of declining expectations, and that's going to continue to be something we grapple with.
All right.
Institutional reform, I think, is probably going to be the other thing to watch for in the next decade, because it seems like a lot of the institutions, I mean, we have in Canada and the U.S. has, are, well, they were set up for the situation 100 or 200 years ago and aren't doing super great in the modern context. And what happens there, and does reform happen to modernize them, is going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I know at the local level, there are a few cities in Canada looking at electoral reform. I'm way more cynical about provincial or federal politics ever moving in that direction at this point after the last few referendums.
Watch Quebec. Quebec is apparently going to run a referendum this year.
Are they actually doing a referendum? Because I thought the parties had all ran on, except the Liberals, on if we get in, we'll do it. But the CAC seems like they walked that back a little.
I think the move now is there is going to be a referendum. So I think that's going to happen. But I didn't look it up before we came on here. So I can't say for sure.
I would love to see some major reforms to our systems. the reforms that have happened in the Senate almost piecemeal and accidentally over the last decade have been interesting, and how that goes, or well, I'll be watching.
Yeah, they're continuing on too. We have a new sort of conservative independent group forming. So mm-hmm. we have the Senate continues to evolve.
And this is the Canada Senate group?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to check because there were so many of those popping up. I just want to make sure I didn't miss something in the past yes. 3 days.
The progressives came and went.
Yeah, yes. So whether they start to champion things like provincial rights a little bit more, that seems like that's one potential avenue they could go. Or just a broadly conservative but not capital C conservative agenda. So that might open up space to take a stronger stance on things like the environment. Who knows? But that's an interesting thing. Again, fairly wonky. It matters at the margins of Canadian politics, but sometimes the margins are where change happens. So,
all right. Well, I think that's plenty for this week. Let's leave it there.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And that has been Politicoast. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergeant Plotnikoff. Editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening.